Blog Talk Radio.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.
Good evening. This is Ken McKeon welcoming you to Nature's Talk Show, and tonight's The Fine Art of Paleontology. Before we get started on our show, though, I'd like to invite everybody to please go to naturestalkshow.com and check out our live chat there on our website. You can get in there. We have some friends already in there, and Ken Borman will be there to field questions and discussion and stuff about our subject tonight. We're going to be talking dinosaurs tonight. So Ken and I, as we take you back in time, we're going to go back to the Cretaceous. So please check out the Nature's Talk Show website and get in the live chat there. So I'm going to say hello to Ken here real quick. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Ken. How are you tonight?
Doing pretty good. Doing pretty good. Boy, I'll tell you what, sometimes I feel guilty moving here to Mexico when I hear about the weather they're having back east anymore. One of the reasons we moved to New Mexico way back in 1985 was to get away from the Midwestern cold winters. And But I got to admit, New Mexico, getting away from the weather was one good thing, but another good thing about it is I was able to become a research associate of the New Mexico Museum of Natural History and Science, and work with paleontology with the museum, and so it's been a whole lot of fun for moving here to New Mexico.
Well, I would normally say I'm envious, but at the moment here in southwestern Ontario, we might have half an inch of snow.
Oh, there you go.
And it's quite patchy.
Half an inch.
And it was 1 degree Celsius today, so I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit. What's that, about 36, 37?
Yeah, above freezing. And that sounds like you got to get New Mexico weather. We get about 1 inch of snow here in this area, and that's a big one.
Yeah. Well, normally we've got like 4 foot drifts at the moment, so it's very abnormal.
Yeah, it was a little bit wetter here, and now it's drying out. And because it's warming up and drying out here in New Mexico, we'll be hitting the field again and pick up where we left off last fall. With our Permian research, we've discovered some nice new bone specimens of an animal called Ophiocodon from the Lower Permian. That's one of my fields of research out here is the Lower Permian for New Mexico Museum of Natural History. But tonight, Ken and I, you know, we're going to take you back to the Cretaceous period and talk about a very interesting group of animals and a particular dinosaur, Tarbosaurus, and its relatives. Now,
yes, this is one I particularly wanted to do. I've been reading a little bit about them recently, and they intrigue me.
Yeah, well, they are intriguing in a way because they're the Asian it and another genus are the Asian representatives of the Tyrannosaurids. You know, they're interestingly enough, they're mostly a North American taxon. And during one of the migrations between the animal exchanges between Asia and North American continent, evidently the Tyrannosaurids were able to migrate to Asia from North America. And that's where we have the evolution of Tarbosaurus.
Excellent. Now, they weren't around when T-Rex was around in North America, were they, Ken?
Actually, I believe when we look at the age separation of Tyrannosaurus rex and Tarbosaurus, Tarbosaurus seems to have evolved just a few million years earlier than T-Rex. I believe its fossils are found in around 70 million year old deposits, and we find T-Rex in deposits that are approximately 68 to 65.5 million years. T-Rex appears to be the last of the Tyrannosaurids that lived.
Maybe we should start by clearing up something. It is my opinion that Tarbosaurus is a valid genus. A lot of paleontologists disagree with that finding, don't they?
There are a few. I think one of the paleontologists, his last name is Carpenter, was the one that I think first said that. But here's the problem that I feel we would have with saying that Tarbosaurus is definitely a Tyrannosaurus type. I think there was enough evolutionary time between the immigration of the Tyrannosaurids from North America to Asia to allow genetic separation. And although they're, you know, even what I think some of the other stuff I've read about it does indicate that Tarbosaurus is actually its own is its own genus.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's related to oh my gosh, which one was it? Was it Alioramus? Was that the other Tyrannosaurid from Asia?
I believe so.
Yeah.
Alioramus. Yeah.
And it appears that these two dinosaurs were actually closer related than Tarbosaurus was to T-Rex. So we are, I kind of go with the, the skeletal evidence that does indicate that when we look at Tarbosaurus, skull features, although they're similar, there are differences indicating a separate, evolution. Also, another interesting thing about Tarbosaurus, too, is it actually had the shortest arms of any of the Tyrannosaurids. So it was continuing the degeneration of their forearms.
Mm-hmm. So, because they're not in a direct line, but they're both from an ancestor, I assume. So T-Rex actually hadn't lost their arms to the same extent as Tarbosaurus.
Yeah, they were longer comparative to the body. So that's kind of interesting. To me, that's another good indication. You know, you got the parts of the skull. I believe one of the differences is in one of the openings behind the eyes. With T-Rex, the eyes were actually able to face forward, so this animal had binocular vision. So, but when we look at Tarbosaurus, the eyes were a little bit further. I guess they looked more to the side of their skull or of their head. So they probably didn't have quite the binocular vision that we see with in T-Rex.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and binocular vision helps you when you're hunting, doesn't it?
It definitely does. It definitely does. That's one of the key things about the primates. We have binocular vision and allows us to see and, you know, judge distances very, very well and pick out things in the, from the surroundings. So we, yeah, I believe we have a question from the chat room, don't we?
Yes, we've got a question. I think it's from David, one of our regular listeners. It's in the chat room, so if anyone else has any questions, please come in and ask your questions, and we'll answer them for you to the best of our ability. Now it says, Ken's. Can you address the scavenger versus hunter debate and give your opinion on which you think was most likely? I recently heard an expert in dinosaur biomechanics saying Tyrannosaurs only ran about 25 miles per hour, but he still believed he was a hunter. What do you think?
That's a very good question, and we want to thank you very much, Dave, and we appreciate you joining us all the time. You know, this is a lot of fun. Well, let's see here. Scavenging versus huntings, you know. That is an interesting debate. One of the things I kind of think maybe about the Tyrannosaurids is as we look at the older ones, I think the older ones might have been more of a scavenger. Compared to the when they were younger, they might have been more active in hunting. Now, there's an interesting thing about whether Tyrannosaurs debate whether they were a group of animals or pack animals or did they hunt alone. And some of the evidence does seem to support, I think you mentioned this, didn't you, Ken, that there is does appear to be evidence that supports they had a pack mentality. They were able to utilize hunting tactics where possibly the more agile and faster running younger members of the pack would drive their prey into the hiding adults where they would be ambushed and killed. I think there's some modern animals that even do that. I think lions are an animal that'll do that, drive prey into an ambush of other lions.
Yeah, that was one thing he hypothesized, to get over the lumbering, fully adult species not being able to run any faster than, as was suggested in the question, say 25 miles an hour. He seemed to think that the youngsters were morphologically different. Like, we know a lot of dinosaurs did change greatly as they matured into adults. And he seems to think that the youngsters were a lot more agile and a lot faster than the adults. So he hypothesized that it would be their job to round up the intended prey and drive them into the ambush type scenario, and the bigger, heavier adults would then just kill the animal and that all share.
Yeah.
And it seems quite plausible to me.
Yeah, it does seem plausible. Now, when we do look at the younger tyrannosaurids, we do see, that they were a little more agile. I guess you could say their proportions were a lot slender. You know, their leg proportions indicated that they could run faster than as they got older. They probably were, very active when they were younger. And it's these are amazing animals when you think about how big they got, the time they lived. One of the interesting things I find, Ken, is when we look at the tyrannosaurs, we got to remember here that there were actually three separate areas that they were living in back in the Cretaceous. Were you aware of that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No. Where was that, Ken?
Well, actually, we have Appalachia, Laramidia, and Asia.
Ah, right. So both sides of the inland sea that we talked about.
Yeah. Now, one of the interesting things that when we look at the evolution of these animals is that we see that appears that the oldest tyrannosaurids did lived in Appalachia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think one of the more basic ones was actually named Appalachiosaurus.
Wow. Yeah. These were definitely cold-blooded, or is there still some dispute about?
I think they were warm-blooded.
Which would, if they were indeed warm-blooded, that would mean that they could possibly move faster too.
Yeah, I think. The modern theropods are warm-blooded, so. I think when we look at the more overall morphology of these animals, the different theropods, especially the coelurosaurians, the birds are related to the coelurosaurians. There's a possibility that T-Rex had feathers. They were could have been a feather, were more than likely a feathered dinosaur.
Right. And like, I guess, like any other modern-day creature, even any of the top predators, they're not averse to, if they come across something that's dead, they're not averse to eating whatever they come across. So they could, depending on the circumstances, be scavengers and hunters, maybe.
I think that's what they were. One of the interesting things about the tyrannosaurids is that they had a large nasal and olfactory cavities and olfactory I forget the name of the part of the brain, but the olfactory part of the brain was really well developed too. One of the other few animals that had olfactory senses like that today is the vultures. And
all right.
Yeah, so these things could smell really good too, So, and they had good vision. When you got that binocular vision, I think that you know, shows that these things could had a good view of what was going on around them as well. So combine that with a good sense of smell. You know, one thing that you mentioned earlier was talking about when they're during their feeding of Tarbosaurus, you know, did they eat everything? And I have a feeling when we look at the Tyrannosaurus, see their teeth, their jaws were some of the most massive crushing forces. And I kind of believe, like you mentioned, you know, that possibly these things ate, you know, bones and everything, you know, just swallowed it all, crunched it up, kind of like modern hyenas do, not leaving much of anything left. And which is one of the reasons we don't see a whole lot of bone fossils for a lot of the herbivores.
Prey animals.
In some places.
Yeah. That was what Curry posited, too. There's a really big disproportionate number of Tarbosaurus skeletons found compared to herbivores. So he assumed that he actually went to Africa and had a look at hyenas eating, and then he went to Indonesia, to Komodo, and looked at Komodo eating. Now that's I would assume a Komodo dragon would be as close as you could get now to the equivalent of a Tarbosaur, and indeed they ate everything.
Yeah. And I imagine that's probably what was happening, you know, when we see this here, because when you got teeth big enough to crush the bones and stuff, you know, it's like, I watch dogs, and dogs got bones in their food. They'll eat the bones and all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's a lot of animals, even, you know, that do that. You know, it's not just restricted to the hyenas stuff. There's a lot of groups of animals that will devour the bones up. And, you know, it's another interesting thing about when we talk about fossil, you know, the reason there's not too many fossils is I wonder in the past how many gnawing type of creatures there were compared to like we see today. Because if you see a skeleton out somewhere, actually rodents and things like that will gnaw it to pieces. I've come across bones like that, you know, showing their teeth marks.
Right. Well, of course, there was very tiny little mammals around in those days. We were there.
Yeah, there was. Yeah, there was a lot of mammals around.
Gnaw on
small
those bones. Yeah.
But it takes a really special way for fossils to form. But of course, we're not going to talk about that this evening here. But when we look at these animals, though, I do think that was one of the things that when it does come to feeding, you know, they were eating everything. Now, I'm kind of interested. I've never studied Cretaceous ichnogenera too much. I've studied the Permian Carboniferous ichnogenera. But, I wonder what the coprolite ratio is of predatory animals in the Cretaceous. It'd be an interesting note. And
I can't remember reading about that in Curry's work that I recently read. So, yeah, that would be interesting.
You know, it's... Well, carnivorous coprolites, the feces of carnivores, is used to high in phosphate, so they fossilize really well. That's why we see it in some of the records, like here in the Permian. We have a lot of carnivore coprolites. The Triassic's the same way. You know, there's lots of carnivore coprolites. And now I have found coprolites with bone in them, indicating that, you know, the animal had been eaten, you know, then passed through the digestive system of its carnivore and then out. And it's rare, but we do find that. And we find a lot of coprolites here in some of the Lagerstätt areas that show fish scales and bones in them where they were a meal. So that's kind of interesting.
It is. Well, I guess we should say, when did we start finding these little, I shouldn't say huge creatures?
When they start finding which
Tarbosaurs.
Ones?
The Tarbosaurs.
When was the first Tarbosaurus here discovered?
I think it was in the 40s.
I believe you're right. I should have known that. Here we go. I believe the first ones were found in 1946 on one of those expeditions to the Gobi Desert. You know, the Gobi Desert there in Mongolia sure does produce a lot of really nice fossils.
Fossilized bones, isn't it?
What's that?
It's just about perfect bones to fossilize.
Yeah. But at any rate, the first ones, I believe the first, they found the skull of it. Now, they went back in 1955, and they found the holotype specimen. And they originally named it Tyrannosaurus. I think it was in 1949 when they was named it Tarbosaurus. I believe that's when the genus Tarbosaurus was erected. And mm-hmm. But what interesting enough here, they found enough specimens that they recognized that there were growth stages of the same species. And so that's when the Tyrannosaurus bator was named Tarbosaurus bator. That was, 1965. So that's when it really became Tarbosaurus.
Wow, it's the same age as me. Oh, it's 50.
Yeah, just a little bit younger than me.
So all different earlier stages that we talked about, they were thought to be different, weren't they? But
they
it was later proven that they weren't different, and there was only one species.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems to be the consensus at the moment. Now, Carpenter was the paleontologist that said, I guess after he examined the material in 1992, decided it belonged in the genus Tyrannosaurus. So that was originally published. And so therein, I think, the controversy has come in, whether it's a Tyrannosaurus or is it a Tarbosaurus, you know. But I think, as I mentioned, with the time differences, the temporal differences, also the geographical positioning of the animals, I would say it's probably safe to call it a Tarbosaurus.
Do you think that it is certainly distinct enough, don't they?
Yeah.
Of course, there's been one in the news lately, too. Wasn't there the Tarbosaurus head that Nicolas Cage had?
I don't know about that. What can you tell us about that?
I see he had some sort of carnivorous dinosaur's head that it was kind of proven that it had been smuggled out of Mongolia at some stage. Not that he knew anything about that, of course, but he thought everything was above board.
Yeah.
But when it was pointed out that he went back to Mongolia.
Oh, be darned. Oh, that's pretty really noble.
I think he paid several million.
Yeah.
That would certainly.
Yeah, you get that could cause a lot of trouble, though. It has to be the thing to do, give it back before you get into trouble. Because we know there's, that's the thing, there's a lot of laws governing vertebrate fossils. When we look at the sales of them, the collecting, A lot of countries are recognizing that they're national treasures, and are starting to stop importation of these animals and stuff. Because I have to agree, working for a museum, I think it's good to that when these organisms are turned over, these fossils for science to study, because it adds to our understanding and the diversity of what was living, in the past, because we just have so few snapshots, scattered with the different things of forms of life. We know life was a whole lot more diverse than what we see in the fossil record, and that's because fossilization is rare. You have to be in the right place to be buried where the animal will turn into a fossil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What else can we say about these dinosaurs?
Well, other than I don't know, Ken. we're able to describe the tarbosaurs pretty fast here. We talked a little bit about the ancestry of the tyrannosaurids. Now there are a number of genera. I think when we look at the Gorgosaurus, Albertosauruses, we have the Dispalatosaurus, Teratonthophonius, Bistiaheviosaur, Lithonax, Tyrannosaurus, Tarbosaurus, Zeucantyrannus. Those are some of the genera of the Tyrannosaurids that we know about right at the moment.
But most of them being in North America?
Yeah, all but I think Tarbosaurus and I've not read much, read anything here about the Zeucantyrannus. Zeucantyrannus is one of the Asian tyrannosaurs found in China. Originally described in 2011, actually. It's a brand new one. They get to about 10 to 12 meters long. Let's see here. It shows that smaller than most specimens of T-Rex. It has a single automorphy that distinguishes it from all the other tyrannosaurids, and that's a the surface of the base of the maxilla. So it's just one of these little thing. I guess if you was to find the fossils without finding that particular difference, it would be confused with any other Tyrannosaurus. We find that a lot in the fossil record out here, Ken. New Mexico has its share of Tyrannosaurids, and we have a whole lot of stuff at the Museum of Natural History that's called Tyrannosaur Indeterminate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they know it's Tyrannosaurid fossils, but we don't know specifically which one, because New Mexico actually has several species of Tyrannosaurid that lived here. I think we had Albertosaurus. I know we've had T-Rex here. What was another one that's been found here? I'll think about it here probably in a minute.
Mm-hmm. If you can, haven't there been one recently in Australia?
Yeah, I believe there was one that they thought was a Tyrannosaurus. But here's the thing here. When we look at the where the Tyrannosaurus evolved and the southern predators, the ones down in, I guess it would have been, so those would have been Gondwana.
Mm-hmm.
Were actually different. I believe they belonged closer to the Allosaurid line. And what we see is, once again, convergent evolution. And I am, my opinion, is the one found in Australia, is one of these showing a convergent evolution from one of the southern lineages of theropod, not related to the T-Rex at all, other than being a theropod,
All right. Okay.
Now, has to be.
So
has to be.
Yet another convergence. We find that a lot, don't we?
It's everywhere.
In the
oh, my gosh. Record. It's just yeah. everywhere.
I guess if something's successful, chances are it will be, it'll pop up in some other area all on its own.
Yeah, well, and the niches. This is another interesting thing that we see about convergence, too, is the environment seems to favor certain evolutionary traits. And if the organism is susceptible to evolution, because we see some organisms that are fairly stable, they don't seem to evolve, then we see other organisms that just, you know, they just run through a whole rapid stage of evolutionary changes, you know, like we see in the vertebrates. So, when we see, these changes evolve, though, nature, it's like when we look at some of the marine animals, as we look through the ages, we see the animals that have returned to the sea, they all sort of converge like a porpoise or something. When we look at we can compare the ichthyosaurs and the modern day, dolphins and porpoises. We can compare, what's another good group is that we can compare these things to? When we look at the phytosaurs and we compare them to the crocodiles, they live in a similar habitat, but they're other than being archosaurs, they're not that closely related. They start out different animals. Crocodilians actually started out as a bipedal animal. They end up looking like they do today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I believe that some of them had super long arms, too, or legs, too, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
So they can certainly move at a fair clip with the long legs. I know the short-legged ones these days can move pretty quick.
You know, one of the interesting things, I've got one of the New Mexico Museum of Natural History for our listeners puts out bulletins each year, which are compilations of papers by paleontologists, and I've actually had the pleasure of being published in one of the bulletins with my finds on Dimetrodon. But you can order these bulletins from the New Mexico Museum of Natural History out here in New Mexico. And one of the interesting ones is it talks about crocodilians and tracks. And it was talking about the way how these animals moved. And it was showing that one of the most primitive, I think, is... the crocodilians off the top of it's just disappeared. It's the pygmy crocodile, I think, the small one.
Right.
And I'm trying to remember where it lives. I think it's in Asia. But at any rate, this crocodile spends a little more time on land, and they notice that it actually has a little bit longer legs, and it seems to favor a more primitive type of gait. And it's kind of interesting, using it, being able to see how these animals might have moved around on land, before they evolved, like the salty crocodile, which is probably a real, really good example of a full-blown animal, returning to the sea.
Yeah, and I know saltwater crocodiles in Australia have been found miles and miles out to sea.
Now,
they're quite comfortable in that environment.
Now, here's an interesting question, Ken. Do you think... from what we've seen in the past in Cretaceous, I wonder if a saltwater crocodile would have the ability to converge with something like one of the pliosaurs or something, like Liopleurodon or something.
No, it's out of that plastic.
There's a lot of similarities. I think... it'd be interesting to know. There's a lot of interesting evolution going on in the world today. It's not static at all. That's one thing I find fascinating. Is we in my lifetime, as we've even seen evidence of evolution and stuff. So it's really fascinating. When we start looking around, we see animals where evolution is working on them. And I don't know. When I look at a saltwater crocodile, I think there's a chance if it wasn't for the human intervention, the new habitats are coming up with the shallow seas that will be or inland areas, you know, flooding of the coastal areas. New niches opening up. It'd be interesting to see what kind of evolution would, you know, will be going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would at that. Certainly.
You know, I guess we could mention something here a little bit about Tarbosaurus. Alioramus was the close related genus I was trying to think of earlier, Alioramus.
Mm-hmm.
But they lived in a similar environment, seems like, as to the T-Rexes here in North America, humid floodplain crossed by river channels. And that's basically when we look at the Tyrannosaurus Rex environment here in New Mexico and up, that it lived along the coastal floodplains on the western part of the inland sea. It would have been the eastern coastal areas of Laramidia. Now, that inland sea that we talked about a couple weeks ago on the show, for our listeners to go back and check it out, that was an interesting deal, not just for the life that was in it, Ken, but I think the way it cut the continent in half, you know?
That certainly spurred evolution into different on either side of the sea to in different directions, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It's kind of fascinating, you know, when I think about that there. When I think of the dinosaurs, now this is kind of funny when you look at the dinosaurs, you see where, you know, most people just see the names, but to see where they actually live, the temporal times of it. And when I look at dinosaur books, I noticed there's one real good one that showed, I can't think of the name of it offhand, but had a lot of good illustrations, but they were all mixed up when it comes to time and space, you know, where the dinosaurs lived. You know, so you didn't really know which particular dinosaur lived, you know, what particular time or who lived with it. They were just, it was, I find that kind of like aggravating in a way. Because when we look at these different ones, you know, they all didn't live together. That's one, I think when we see movies like Jurassic Park and you see them all thrown in together there,
yeah.
You know, and I think that confuses a lot of people, too, to know that Tarbosaurus was, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of other Tyrannosaurs living with it. Matter of fact, I think there's only a point in time when we know that there were two Tyrannosaurs living together, and I think it was Gorgosaurus and Albertosaurus.
Right.
Yeah. And that's only two species that were known to be living together. So these animals were basically, you know, one species living with a smaller number of other smaller theropod predators. But you have the one apex predator.
Yes, they were the top dog.
Yeah. And Tarbosaurus, during its time, would have been the top dog. And we're talking, once again, about 70 million years ago. And it was just a few million years older than North America's T-Rex. So it would have went extinct before North America's T-Rex probably even evolved, or about the time it evolved.
Right. And stage, there was no further mixing of the animal life between the two continents?
Just appears maybe once or twice was all there was.
Right.
And,
okay.
Yeah. And but T-Rex or the Tyrannosaurids do appear to have evolved in North America, basically in Appalachia. That's where we find the oldest ones. Probably before the inland sea really got going. That's when they covered the North American continent. Then when the inland sea started cutting off the areas, you know, during one of the regressions, they were probably able to immigrate up through Alaska over and across and into Asia. And at that same period of time that we had the Tyrannosaurids immigrating into Asia, we had some of the Ceratopsians and a few of the other dinosaurs that immigrated from Asia into North America. So that's when we see, you know, we had our animal exchange.
I read a book recently by Bob Backer that posited that Utah raptor actually is one of those animals that crossed from Asia, evolved in Asia, crossed the land bridge, and came into North America.
I would agree with that because we know that the Velociraptor itself, those guys evolved in the the Mongolian desert area. Back then, it wasn't quite the desert it is today.
Right.
A lot more life, a lot more plant life and such. But the Velociraptor. Now, an interesting thing to note is Utah Raptor. That was basically what they based the big Velociraptors in the movie Jurassic Park on. But the true Velociraptor was actually a small animal, barely about 5 feet long at a meter and a half or so in full length, and less than a meter tall at the highest point of it.
Actually, in that book I just read, it's quite a famous book. It's Raptor Red. Anyone wants to check it out? It's a great read. In the introduction, Dr. Backer says that he was doing consulting for the original movie, and apparently Spielberg kept saying, make them bigger, talking about the raptors, of course.
Yeah.
And he kept saying, there is no analog to anything that lived that big. And they'd come up with these dinosaur theropod raptors, bigger. And Spielberg would say, no, make them bigger. So they kept making them bigger until they got to the right size. And lo and behold, it's not one of our old guests on our show, Jim Kirkland, I believe it was, discovered Utah Raptor. And they worked out that it was roughly the size that Spielberg wanted his raptors to be.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, yeah. And it was just before the movie was released. So, and
I love it
that
when
made
stuff
great,
lines up
great
like
news.
That.
So, at the time, everyone knew that it was actually Utah Raptor. Well, but they kept calling them Velociraptors in the movie. So that's
yeah,
quite an interesting little aside.
Yeah, I think the little Velociraptors would have been an interesting dinosaur.
It does describe the across the continents, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. You know, wonder for you, though. What's that?
It's a good example of that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting over the as we look at how the continents move around, the seas, transgress, regress, land bridges form, you know, how life moves around. It's just really, I love the dynamic Earth. That's one of the things that I think since I was a kid, you know, makes studying it fun. You know, it's the Earth is not, it's not still, it's dynamic, it moves, it lives. And, you know, it's just so fantastic.
Mm-hmm. It certainly is.
Well, so, I hope. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, anything else you can tell us about Tarbosaurus, Ken?
Well, I was going to say, I think we've just about covered it. I think we're going to end the show just a little bit early tonight.
Mm-hmm.
It's once again, I think the fossil record indicates that it is definitely its own genus. I don't
mm-hmm.
believe it, you know, although it's closely related to the Tyrannosaurus from North America, I think it's had enough time to diverge. By the time we get the T-Rex itself, the T-Rex is a later dinosaur and did not come back from the line that Tarbosaurus belongs to. It continued on with its own divergence as well. And I think we can... we should be able to safely say that Tarbosaurus is its own genus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was decided that it was quite probably not cold-blooded.
Yeah, definitely a warm-blooded animal. I think most of the theropods were warm-blooded.
And to answer that question earlier, we decided that it was definitely a hunter, but then again, if it came across a dead animal, it wouldn't be averse to scavenging that carcass.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I've seen too many other animals do that, you know. I think that's just the way of life, you know. And that's one of the things about these big animals like that, you know, they able to recycle matter like that.
Well,
now,
we've seen that in our fish tanks, haven't we, Ken?
We certainly do.
what we think are plant eaters, herbivorous fish, they're not averse to taking a little bit of extra protein every now and again, are they?
Oh, my African Lake cichlids, they eat chopped fish and chopped crayfish and other protein, absolutely, you know, brine shrimp and stuff. So anything to get an edge up, they will do it. And, mm-hmm. I've seen them when a fish dies, the other fish will pick it apart and scavenge it.
Yep.
You know, definitely nothing wrong with that. So they're an interesting animal. I think what we could say about Tarbosaurus, though, Ken, is it's a typical tyrannosaurid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yes.
A little bit smaller than T-Rex, but still a substantial animal.
Yeah, yeah. Most of the several of the tyrannosaurids like that were substantial for their size. You know, when we look at the Gorgosaurus, Albertosaurus, you know, they were big animals too. I would not want to meet one in a dark forest.
No.
Yeah.
And,
so,
and even the slow adult ones, if they could run at 20 now, they could certainly outrun me.
Yeah. Oh man. I'd figure out a way to be good at hiding. I'd go back to the old mammal instinct there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's what the mammals were doing at that time in the Cretaceous,
yeah.
Aren't they?
Yeah, you hid from them suckers. All right.
Make yourself small.
Yeah. All right.
No,
well, pretty cool animal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've got a show for us next time.
What's that?
I think we ought to talk about the first of the large herbivore systems with Dafosaurus and some of its other contemporaries like Diadectes. These were the first big cows way back in the Carboniferous and the Permian. They were the first animals to set up the modern, or what we call a modern herbivorous ecosystem. So we'll dip back to the Pennsylvanian and Permian and talk about the large predators, herbivores.
Okay.
And the interesting thing about Dafosaurus is it's is a pelycosaur that was a cousin of Dimetrodon, and that also means it was a cousin of ours.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And also, Didectes was a Permian cow that got almost 3 meters long at the time. So one of the big ones.
Oh, that's going to be me.
Yeah. And also, coming up, I'm going to let our listeners, too, that you and I are going to be talking on Monsters of Nature about the Candiru coming up here this next Sunday.
Yes, evil little catfish, aren't they?
Evil, evil little catfish. So we'll be talking about the most feared fish in South America, not the piranha, it's the Candiru. So
mm-hmm.
You want to join us for that there, too. So, all right. Well, Ken, this has been fun.
Yeah, actually, we should mention, too, Ken, if any of our listeners want to come along and meet us, we're having our first public appearance. Tom and Mary and myself are going to be at the NEC convention. That's the Northeast Council Convention. It's on April 8th to the 10th at Rocky Hill, Connecticut. If you're in the area, drop by and say hello. You don't really have to be interested in fish. We'll be in the vendor room. Just drop by and say g'day, and we'll have a little chat. I'd like to meet anyone who listens to any of our shows. So come along. If you're into fish, well, think about making a weekend of it. It should be a great weekend with plenty of great speakers and all the usual things that happen in a fish convention.
I got the opportunity a couple years ago to be a guest speaker at the NEC conference, and it was a blast. And getting to meet a lot of my old friends. There's people I knew from from the AKA and other fish friends. I met new people that I just talked to on Facebook and chatted with, and it was a blast. So definitely go to the NEC conference. Now, Ken, you and I and our fellow Tank Topic host, Ron Bishop, are going to be getting together in the middle of May, aren't we? We're going to be raising hell in Ontario.
Yes, we are in London, Ontario, for the annual KOAC convention. The London Aquarium Club is hosting it this year, and it should be a great event.
Yeah, come on out and listen to the program.
Speakers.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, then come out and listen to the program. I'll be presenting there at the show and talk with you and me. We can talk about fossils, fish, or anything else that we talk about. So you can, and I'm looking forward to this event too, because Ken, it'll be the first time I get to meet you in person, you and Ron Bishop. So I'm really looking forward to hanging with you guys.
It'll be great.
It will be.
If anyone is coming to talk to us, if you want any books from Lisa Slayer Bookstore, it doesn't matter what subject, have a look at my stocks. If you want any of them, let me know beforehand and I'll bring them along, and that'll save you on postage, which is quite considerable these days too. So you'll save a bit of money. So if you want anything from Lisa Slayer Bookstore, just let me know.
And I'll be bringing some of my artwork along as well. And but anyway, it'll be fun. You get to talk to us. And for those who will be out in the South or the West, also over Memorial Day weekend, I'm going to be up at Denver, Colorado, at the American Killifish Association National Convention. I'll be doing their awards and also be presenting a program there as well. So you can come out and visit with me if you're going to be in that area. And we can talk all kinds of fun stuff as theirs, and so it'll be a blast. So Ken and I will be out and about, and you guys can meet us and have a good and hang out with us. So with that there, I just want to ask people to please, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, follow us on Blog Talk Radio. Please check us out on it, and click on the follow button there, PayPal button on our website to help donate money to our show, or you can visit our store and get coffee mugs and shirts and stuff. Sign up for our newsletters, all kinds of great stuff about the upcoming shows, because Ken and I have a lot of shows planned for you this coming year, and we got a lot of great places in time and space and stuff that we're going to take you. We've even added a show called Nature's Wonders, where we'll be talking about things not only interesting plants and things or animals and stuff here on the planet, but also we'll be talking about space stuff as well. So all kinds of interesting stuff. We're going to have trying to plan a show about the weather on that, so that'll be fun. So anyway, if you have suggestions for us, please let Ken or myself know, or Mary or any of us here at Nature's Talk Show. Visit our chat room, as we said. Also, you can listen to our archive shows. And we just want to thank everybody for joining us and listening in to Ken and me as we ramble on about the wonders of nature, huh, Ken?
That's right. It's always educational for me, and I hope it is for all our listeners, too.
Well, what's fun is every time I do one of the shows, I find out more and more myself, so you're just never too old to learn, and you should never stop learning. It's just what makes life wonderful, in my opinion. So, anyway, thank you very much, Ken, for another wonderful time to visiting with you.
And thank you, Ken.
All right, you're welcome. And thank our listeners. And I'm going to let us go. I'm going to go and kick back now. Good night, everybody, and join us here next time on Nature's Talk Show. Bye-bye.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.